This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, June 30th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. The Supreme Court term has just ended, and it's already changed a lot since the death of Justice Scalia earlier this year. Hillary Clinton spoke in March about the court and the election.
As scary as it might be, ask yourselves, what kind of justice would a President Trump appoint? As you know, he believes Muslims should be banned from entering this country because of their faith. What would that mean for a nation founded on religious freedom? He says wages for working people are too high and we shouldn't raise the minimum wage. What would that mean for working people and a court that's already tilting in favor of powerful corporations?
Jeffrey Toobin joins me to discuss the most important decisions this term and what the coming years might look like under Clinton or Trump. So, Jeff, we have talked many times before, actually, about the intellectual and political power of Scalia. How has his death affected the court?
It's been an enormous, enormous change at the court. Independent of his intellectual achievements, Justice Scalia was a thoroughgoing and reliable conservative vote who is now gone. So there are now four mostly reliable conservative votes, four mostly liberal votes, and the difference between a 5-4 conservative majority and a 4-4 ideological split was enormously important and visible throughout the rest of the term.
And what about his dogged pursuit of the philosophy of originalism? He was really the foremost proponent of that in the country.
He was, and he very much put that philosophy on the map. He never entirely persuaded even his conservative colleagues that his method of interpretation, originalism, the idea that the Constitution should be interpreted as it was understood by the framers, he never even persuaded all of his colleagues. He had intermittent success with that. But he had tremendous influence on the public, especially in the Republican Party. So I think in many respects, his influence was greater outside the court than inside in terms of matters of interpretation.
There were three really important decisions right in the past week, two of which have been perceived and are victories for, you know, roughly called the left, the abortion ruling and the affirmative action case. Could you talk a little bit about both of them?
You know, for all that we, have focused on the absence of Justice Scalia, what those two cases remind us is that this is still Anthony Kennedy's court, and that if you want a majority now that the court is split 4-4, you have to have Anthony Kennedy. And he is a mercurial figure. He has gone in different directions, including on the two very issues that were in the big cases this year on affirmative action. Previously, he had voted to strike down virtually every affirmative action program that he had ever been presented with since he's joined the court in 1987. But he joined with the court, the court's four liberals, for a 5-3 decision upholding the affirmative action program at the University of Texas at Austin, which really does give universities a pretty clear green light to use race as one factor in admissions.
The abortion ruling has been described as the most important since Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1992, which upheld Roe.
I agree. After 2010, where there were Republican landslides in so many states, states decided to try to regulate abortion virtually out of existence. They basically created so-called programs to protect women's health, they said, by saying that abortion clinics had to be essentially surgical level of equipment and that the doctors there had to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. What the abortion rights groups said in challenging the Texas law was that this was not designed to protect women's health. It was merely a pretext to try to drive abortion clinics out of business. And Justice Kennedy agreed with the four liberals. And again, in a 5-3 opinion written by Justice Stephen Breyer, said that the Texas rules about the clinics created an undue burden. That was the legal buzzword that was at issue, an undue burden on women's right to choose abortion. And it's going to mean almost certainly that many, many states' rules will be now struck down.
But Right to Life activists in Texas have said they're going to continue to challenge other abortion regulations in the state. How significant is that? What can they do?
I mean, what was so impressive about Justice Breyer's opinion is that he very meticulously investigated the claims that said these regulations were designed to protect women's health, and found that, in fact, they were not, that they did nothing to protect women's health. They singled out abortion when other surgical procedures were much more dangerous, liposuction, childbirth, where there were none of these special regulations. And they gave the lower courts very clear instructions that unless states can prove that their regulations of abortion clinics are actually designed and do protect women's health, they should be struck down. And Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in a very brief concurring opinion that I think suggests how the liberals are feeling their oats, she basically wrote an opinion chiding Texas, saying, "We mean what we say. Don't come back here with your lousy regulations unless they're real." And I think it just shows that the liberals are ascendant at the Supreme Court right now.
Do you think this will be an issue in the general election campaign?
You know, it's a peculiar thing. I mean, certainly the Republicans who are reluctantly rallying to Donald Trump, one of the first things they all say, I certainly heard Paul Ryan say it this week, is, look, we need to protect the Supreme Court, and Donald Trump will appoint conservative justices who will not rule in favor of abortion rights. Trump is an imperfect messenger on this issue. You know, he gave a famous interview to Tim Russert many years ago where he described himself as very, very pro-choice. He has switched on this, as on so many issues.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
There was the ruling on President Obama's immigration plan, which must have given heart to all of the anti-immigration crusaders. This end was a huge blow, obviously, to millions of undocumented immigrants. Explain the legal import of that.
Well, you know, this was, again, another very important case, and the one of the three where the liberals didn't win. This program that the president enacted administratively dealt with the people who came to the United States illegally and then had children who were American citizens, that is, born here. And so what President Obama did was he put in place a program called DACA that allowed these people, if they had clean criminal records, to go through a background check process that would essentially allow them to get jobs, come out of the shadows, work legally, and function. What Texas claimed, again, the state of Texas was the plaintiff in this case. They said that this was an abuse of executive power, that the government, if it wanted to do a program like this, it had to have an act of Congress. The president couldn't do it unilaterally. Texas won in the district court. The district court issued a nationwide injunction saying the program couldn't go forward. a split panel of the Fifth Circuit, very conservative court, upheld the lower court's ruling. And the Supreme Court split 4-4 on this issue, meaning that this injunction against the president's program would be upheld.
What does that mean practically?
Here's where things get a little technical. The answer is, in theory, yes. The president has said that he is using his prosecutorial discretion not to deport these people. However, they cannot work legally. There is no process for them now to come out of the shadows. So the president has said, and a new president could reverse this, that I am using my prosecutorial discretion not to deport the DACA people, but they don't have the security of knowing that they will not be deported in the future, and they don't have the security of being able to go through this process and begin to work legally.
As we've discussed, the Senate is blocking Obama's choice for Scalia's replacement, Merrick Garland. So does that mean necessarily that there will be an 8-member court at least through the election?
The question that arises is what happens in the lame duck if Hillary Clinton wins, and especially if the Senate goes Democratic? Do the Republicans say to themselves, look, as Democratic appointees go, Merrick Garland is very much a moderate. He's also will be 63 years old, so he won't be on the court for decades and decades. Why don't we just take the bird in the hand and instead of waiting for Hillary Clinton to nominate someone who might be younger and more liberal? Mitch McConnell has rejected that, but I tend to believe it won't happen. I think it is just the Senate is too locked in to opposing the president on this issue. And I think they figure that they will just oppose Hillary Clinton's nominee and try to block that nominee as well as Merrick Garland, not let President Obama have Merrick Garland confirmed as a final act.
Give us a little history here about a little political history here about the court. Remind us about the role of the Four Horsemen who opposed FDR's New Deal and what happened to them, because this plays directly into some of the considerations people have now about an aging court.
Right. Well, just in the middle years of the New Deal, the conservatives led by the so-called Four Horsemen struck down many of President Roosevelt's big initiatives on grounds that they were unconstitutional. And it led to the president's unsuccessful court packing plan. But ultimately, time took care of the problem. That FDR had enough appointments. One of the justices in the middle changed his mind about these issues, and the issue took care of themselves. What's significant, I think, is that once the conservatives started losing these cases consistently, they, in short order, left the court. They didn't feel like it was worth it to keep fighting a losing battle. That raises the issue of what will happen on the Supreme Court if it does, in fact, move to the left. If Obama or Clinton fills a fifth seat, there's a clear liberal majority. What does Clarence Thomas do, who's 68? What does Anthony Kennedy do, who's 80? To say nothing of Ruth Ginsburg, the liberal, who will be 83, Stephen Breyer, who will be 79, will there be a rush to the exits at the court? I don't know for sure, but you know, I do think we are looking at the possibility of several resignations in the next few years.
Do you see any sign of the Republican Party having a strategy in the case of a Clinton presidency? And in the case of a Democratic Senate?
Yeah, which is defeat any nominee. You know, I think that Republicans recognize that, in a largely dysfunctional government, the Supreme Court is where decisions are made. Nothing is more important than the Supreme Court, as we have seen with Obamacare and abortion and affirmative action. And you have a group of senators, Ted Cruz, Tom Cotton, Mike Lee, who I think are going to filibuster anyone appointed by a Democratic president in the next few years. So even if Merrick Garland is renominated, I think Supreme Court nominations are going to be a complete war.
Okay, thank you so much, Jeff.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer and the author, most recently, of The Oath, The Obama White House, and The Supreme Court. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker apps, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. And you can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. We're off next week, and we'll be back on July 14th. The Political Scene is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.